Hi, hey, welcome to The Cordial Catholic, a podcast for non-Catholics, new Catholics, and those looking to dig deeper into the Catholic faith. I'm K. Albert Little, an evangelical, non-denominational convert to Catholicism, and this podcast is born out of one particular idea. It began when a pastor I was working for asked me what's more important, the Bible or tradition. As an evangelical in my early 20s, I thought the answer was easy. But as I began to dig into the history of the Bible, into its formation, into how the scriptures were written and collected and preserved, as I began to study the history of Christianity, I encountered the ancient Catholic Church. It was then, as I began to read about Catholicism from actual Catholic sources, that I realized that what I knew about Catholics was wrong. It was based largely on misunderstandings and misinformation. This podcast exists to fill in that gap. The gap between what you think Catholics believe and what we actually do. We have real Catholic conversations with influential Catholic thinkers from the heart of the Catholic Church. No misinformation here. And this episode, this very episode, is, I think, so important. I'm joined by senior apologist from Catholic Answers, Jimmy Akin, to talk about the problem of evil and suffering. Why is there evil? Why do people suffer? It's incredibly timely and incredibly important, and Jimmy has spent decades as an apologist trying to figure out, trying to explain and understand problems just like this one. It's a fantastic conversation. I can't underscore that enough, and I think you'll love it. I think you'll be deeply moved and informed and edified by our conversation. Two quick things. First of all, I want to thank two new patrons this week. Thank you to Darren for your monthly contribution. I couldn't do it without you. Welcome to the show. Thank you for being here as a sponsor and a listener. And thank you to David for your generous one-time donation. Guys, all of your support helps to keep this show rolling, keep things running, and allows me to continue to bring these fantastic conversations to you. So thank you. Thank you for listening for an hour or so of your time. I know how important, how precious that can be. And thank you as well to my patrons for your financial support. You guys are fantastic. And the last thing is this. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. Welcome to all the new listeners. I'm privileged to be able to enter into your houses, your spaces, your ears. I really do feel blessed to be able to bring you these conversations, especially during these difficult times. Please know I am praying for you. Please pray for me. Please get in touch, cordialcatholic@gmail.com, to let me know how I can help you. God bless you guys. And now, without any further ado, here's my fantastic conversation with Jimmy Akin on the problem of evil and suffering. Please listen and enjoy. Hey, friends, and welcome back to the podcast. I'm very excited to welcome back returning guest, Jimmy Akin. Jimmy is senior apologist at Catholic Answers. He is a frequent, regular guest on Catholic Answers Live. He is an instructor in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics. And he is the author of a number of fantastic books, including A Daily Defense, 365 plus 1 days to Becoming a Better Apologist, Teaching with Authority, and what I think is one of the best and certainly the most information-packed and accessible books on the Bible, The Bible is a Catholic Book. He is, of course, the host of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, one of my favorite podcasts, and he is here today to join us to talk about the problem of evil and suffering. Jimmy, thank you for joining us again on the show. Welcome and hello.
Howdy, and thank you very much for having me back.
All right, Jimmy, this is a really important topic, and as you can imagine, I'm sure you're getting all kinds of calls on Catholic Answers Live about this. I'm getting tons of feedback from my listeners asking for a guest to speak about this topic, these days especially. So I'm very excited to have you here. I wonder if we can begin by talking about kind of the two ways of understanding the problem of evil, because we can tackle the problem of evil and suffering in the world from kind of a philosophical point of view, but there also is this emotional, kind of personal problem of evil and suffering. So I wonder if you can kind of give us a brief outline of these two different ways of understanding the problem of evil.
Well, to my mind, they're really different aspects of the same underlying problem. Now, we should start by talking about what we mean by evil, because people have a different sense in common speech of what that means compared to what theologians and philosophers mean when they talk about evil. Normally, in everyday speech, when people say something is evil, they mean that it's morally evil, that it's, you know, however you want to say it, it's morally bad, it's unethical, it's immoral, it's wicked, it's sinful, whatever, however you want to phrase it. But they have in mind what otherwise is called moral evil by philosophers and theologians. So that would include things like being cruel to other people, killing innocent people, violating your ethical commitments, things like that. And that's not, although that is part of what we mean by the problem of evil. The problem of evil does cover why does God allow moral evil. It also covers another form of evil, which is what philosophers and theologians call physical evil. Physical evil is anything that is not moral evil. And so that includes things like physical suffering, emotional suffering, diseases, famines, death, sicknesses, things like that. And these days, living with the coronavirus pandemic, it's really physical evil that is mostly on people's minds. Now, having said that, there are different ways that the problem of evil impacts people. And sometimes it impacts people in a more theoretical way, in an intellectual way, where it's they're looking at the situation in the world and saying, hey, there's evil out there, whether moral or physical, but it's not really engaging them that much personally on an emotional level. And there still remains, though, the question intellectually, well, why would a good God allow evil to exist? Or even for non-theists, why does evil exist? Because this is not just a problem in theistic religions. It's also a problem for atheists and for polytheists and for, you know, people of every religious persuasion. It's a fact of life that evil is out there in the universe. There is more, people do things they shouldn't, and also undeniably things like suffering exist. And so every worldview has to have some answer to the problem of why evil exists. But even if you're not being impacted personally by it at the moment, there is still this intellectual problem that everyone has to wrestle with. Then there are occasions in life where, especially when we ourselves are suffering, or when someone close to us that we care about is suffering, where it becomes very personal. And it's not just an intellectual problem. It's also something that we feel very much on the emotional level, not just the intellectual level. And that poses its own challenges, how to help someone who's in that situation where either they or someone they really care about is experiencing evil. And it even though the fundamental answers to the problem of evil are the same, you know, the intellectual reasons for evil don't change, there are special considerations that have to be brought to bear in terms of how we approach a person who is in the midst of suffering and is feeling the problem of evil in an intense way, and how can we best help that person?
Yeah, I'm thinking of a personal example. I was reading Professor Eleanor Stump has a fantastic book on evil and suffering. It's really informed a lot of how I understand the subject. And I was reading that that giant book while I got sick. So I was sick. I was physically suffering. And reading the theory of suffering and trying to reconcile these two things, you know, I knew in my head why I was suffering, according to these theologians from the church. But then the actual impact of that suffering, it even for me on that level, became very difficult to reconcile these two things, the theory, the head knowledge, but then the actual experiential suffering I was going through. I mean, it was a flu. It wasn't very serious, but it was a small example of those two things held kind of in tension. So I want to unpack this problem, and I wonder if we can begin on more of the theoretical side, and by the end of this discussion, I want to move towards more of a pastoral or more of a personal approach. But I want to begin, if we can, by looking at this in a broad picture. What do we say in general to a person who just comes out and kind of says, in the face of all this suffering, you know, why would God allow suffering?
Okay. I guess it's good to start by putting the problem kind of in its starkest terms. So now, other systems of thought, whether they're atheistic or polytheistic or pantheistic, whatever, they'll have their own approaches to this. But in terms of the theistic problem of evil, it's often put in terms of a trilemma. According to the standard theistic picture of God, God is all good, so he's omnibenevolent, he's all-knowing, so he's omniscient, and he's all-powerful, so he's omnipotent. And then, so there are those three facts about God according to the classical picture of theism, and then there's this fourth fact, which is evil exists. And that fourth fact is then used to create a challenge for the first three facts. If God is omnipotent, then he has the power to stop evil from existing. If he's omniscient, then he knows how to stop evil from existing, and he also knows that it exists. And if he's omnibenevolent, you would think he would want to stop evil from existing. And so how can these three things be true about God? How can we have an all-good, all-knowing, all-powerful God who nevertheless allows evil to exist? And there are different approaches that theists have taken to this dilemma. Not all of them are good. Some, for example, like you may remember a book, you're young enough, you may not have been around when it was popular, but there was a book that was very popular a few decades ago by Rabbi Harold Kushner, called Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. And this is a book that Rabbi Kushner wrote following the birth of his son, who had progeria. Progeria is a genetic disorder, so it's not anything you've done it to yourself through your own fault. It's something that just happens to you. And progeria causes the body to behave in such a way that very young people display the symptoms of old age very quickly in their lives, and they don't live very long. If memory serves, they live into their mid-20s. And so Rabbi Kushner's son was born with progeria through no fault of his own, and he had to deal with all of the suffering that involved. And that led Rabbi Kushner to meditate on the problem of evil and why, and ask himself why a good God would allow this. And his conclusion was that the three classical facts about God couldn't all be true, that God couldn't be all good and all knowing and all powerful. And his solution was to say God's not all powerful. That God is all good, and he would eliminate evil if he could, but he just can't. that there's a limitation to God's power and he's not able to help people. Now, in saying that, Rabbi Kushner departed from the standard understanding of classical theism. Another solution was proposed even earlier by the philosopher Leibniz back in the early modern period. And Leibniz dealt with it from a slightly different angle. What Leibniz said was that, in essence, there is a certain amount of evil that's intrinsic to existence. And so God couldn't eliminate it. It's beyond the power of omnipotence to do that. Now, in order to explain that, we have to mention, well, what is what is omnipotence? Because sometimes people will try to pose paradoxes like, well, could God, if he's all powerful, could he make a stone so heavy he can't lift it? And it would seem on the surface that, well, if he can make such a stone, then there's something he can't do, namely lift it. And if he can't make such a stone, then again, there's something he can't do, namely make it. When I was in grad school, and we were talking about this question one day in class, I said, I was a philosophy grad student. I said, well, no, God couldn't make a stone too heavy for him to lift, because if it was too heavy for him to lift, it would collapse in under its own weight and cease to be a stone and become a black hole. And my professor said, welcome to academia. You have just answered the question without engaging the issue. Now, what Leibniz's view was that we're living in the best of all possible worlds. So he would say what an all good God would do is make the best of all possible worlds. And he did. And that world contains suffering. And therefore, there's an intrinsic aspect of evil to reality. And so omniscience can't eliminate that, because what omniscience is not the ability to do anything you can say. You can say all kinds of things, like God could make a four-sided triangle. Well, okay, on the surface you can say that, but if you think about it, well, what would it mean for something to be four-sided and a triangle? I mean, you can't do that in a flat closed plane. If something has four sides, it's a quadrilateral, it's not a triangle. And so there's an inherent contradiction, or what philosophers call a logical contradiction, a contradiction in the terms that are involved in saying something like four-sided triangle, or square circle, or married bachelor, or any number of other such things. You can say those things, but if you think about them, there's a contradiction in the very terms involved. And theologians, going all the way back to people like Thomas Aquinas, have said that's not what omniscience involves. That's not what omnipotence involves. Omnipotence is the ability to do anything that's logically possible, not anything that you can say. And so entities like four-sided triangles or square circles or married bachelors can't exist by their nature. There's a contradiction there. That's really just gibberish. It's word salad. And so so Leibniz would have held that the idea of that the best of all possible worlds would not include evil in some form would be just word salad. It would involve a contradiction, and so that's why God can be all powerful and all good and still not make a world that that doesn't involve evil. Now, that's Leibniz's solution. But from the Catholic point of view, that's a load of fetid dingo's kidneys. God does not have to make a world that includes evil. He could make, and also furthermore, that there is no such thing as a best of all possible worlds. God could always make a better world. He could always have one more saint. He could always have one more act of kindness in the world. He could, there's no, to use a fancy philosophical term, there's no intrinsic maximum to the goodness of the world. If God has made a world that has a billion units of goodness in it, he could make a world that has a trillion units of goodness in it. And so the idea of a best of all possible worlds, ironically, is itself a logical contradiction. There is no such thing. And so consequently, God is not obliged to make the best of all possible worlds any more than he is obliged to make a four-sided triangle. It's up to God to pick how good of a world he's going to create. And that world does not have to involve evil. It could not have evil in it. In fact, one day, according to the Christian faith, God will have a world where, at least in among the community of the saved, there will be no more evil. Because when we die in God's friendship, our wills are fixed on good, and we may be able to choose among various forms of good, but we won't be choosing anything evil at that point. And similarly, we won't have pain and suffering anymore. That's one of the things that the book of Revelation promises, that eventually God will wipe away every tear and there will be no more pain or weeping or suffering anymore because the old things have passed away. And if God could do that in the future, he could have done that in the beginning. He could have created the world in a consummated state where there is no more suffering and no more moral evil. And the question is then, well, why didn't he do that? Now, the fundamental answer that's going to be proposed by the Catholic faith, at least, is that God, the reason that God allows evil is to bring good out of it. It's not that he couldn't create a world with no evil. It's that he uses the very evil that's in the world to bring about good. And that is consistent with God's obligations as an all-good being. So you may say, well, how does that work? Well, on a practical level, we can dig down into more of the details on this, but on a practical level, think about a situation let's say a millionaire comes to you and says, "Hey, I'll give you $1 million if you do something that involves a little bit of pain. Let's say let me give you an injection for the coronavirus, and not only will it give you immunity to the coronavirus, I'll give you $1 million on top of that." Would you view that as a fair deal?
That seems like an unfair deal from the millionaire's perspective, well, I would think.
But from your perspective, Albert, would you view that as a good deal on your behalf?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty good deal.
Would you leap at a deal like that?
I certainly would.
Yeah, so would I. getting immunity to the coronavirus and getting $1 million, and all I have to do is take a shot. Wow, I would be all over that deal. So that reveals how we as individuals can say rationally, okay, I can accept a certain amount of evil, as long as a greater good comes out of it. If I have a greater good occur to me, I can handle a little bit of evil. And it's rational for me to do that, and I wouldn't look at the generous millionaire doctor with the coronavirus cure and say, oh, that's unfair of him. I would say, sign me up today. And in the same way, no matter what the evil we experience is, from the Christian perspective, God will make sure that an equal or greater good comes out of it. And so as long as he's doing that, as long as he's bringing about equal or greater good for us out of the evils we experience, he's doing what he's within his obligations as an all-good creator, and he's not treating us unfairly, he's not treating us badly. If he allows us to suffer, he also will compensate us for it. And thus, he's not doing anything wrong because he's making it up to us for anything that we've suffered. And this is one of the teachings that we find in Scripture, that when the innocent suffer, God will make it up to them. And it may not be made up in this life, it may be made up in the next life, but fundamentally, the good that God has for us vastly outweighs the sufferings that we may be experiencing in this life, whether it's someone injuring us or something injuring us physically, or whether we're suffering because of someone's morally evil choices, whatever we're suffering in this life, God will more than make it up to us. And so thus, in his letters, St. Paul says that God enters into everything for those that love him to bring about good. And he also says that the sufferings of this life are not worth comparing to the weight of glory that God has in store for us. So no matter what you're suffering, and St. Paul is, you know, facing martyrdom on repeated occasions in his life, and he finally was martyred. Well, from his point of view, even something as extreme as the hardships he experienced in his ministry and all the great dangers he went through and even his eventual martyrdom that he knew was always a prospect, in spite of all those sufferings, he had the conviction, which he then taught under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit from the Catholic point of view, that God will more than make up to us anything that we have innocently suffered in this life. And so that's the fundamental assurance that we have. And that's the fundamental answer from the Christian point of view to the problem of evil, that God, if he allows us to suffer, he will also more than make it up to us.
I want to stretch out your vaccination idea a little bit further here, because I'm wondering, from a Catholic point of view, is it fair to say, I mean, imagine that there's only one way of avoiding a certain disease, only one cure for something, and it's this needle, right? It's a little bit of evil. Is it fair to say, from a Catholic point of view, that when we suffer, would the Church say that suffering was the best way or the only way that God could have brought out the good he was intending? Like that needle, there's no other way to get the cure for that thing other than that needle. That was the best delivery method to reach the cure. Is it fair to say the same thing about suffering from the Church's point of view?
I think we have to distinguish here between moral and physical evil. So one of the questions that gets asked in this discussion is about moral evil, even though we've been primarily discussing physical evil. Is there a reason why God would have to allow moral evil? And the answer there is yes, if he wants to allow free will. Because if you're going to have moral agents with free will, then you've got to allow them to abuse that free will. Otherwise, it's not free. If they are guaranteed, it's not fully free, at least. If they're guaranteed to always choose good, then they have a restricted degree of freedom along at least one axis. Now, God is okay with eventually confirming our wills in either good or evil. So the saints and angels have their freedom confirmed in goodness, so they may choose among different good things, but they never choose evil. Similarly, the lost and demons have had their freedom confirmed in evil, so even though they may choose among various things, they will never choose to repent and come back to God, so he lets them become confirmed in that state. But for both us and angels, he wanted us to have the opportunity to choose between good and evil, and for humans, that occurs over a period of time while we're alive here on this earth. Our wills can go back and forth. We have a chance to revisit our decisions. Theologians generally have thought that angels chose all in a moment because their consciousnesses don't work the same way as ours do, but that's theological speculation rather than church teaching. But God wanted both our race and the angels to have the opportunity to choose between good and evil. So he wanted us to have this greater kind of free will, and then at some point what's called our probationary period or our probation ends and we're confirmed in either good or evil. Well, why would God allow this? Why would God want this type of freedom? The leading proposal is that he wanted to allow this type of freedom in order to allow a certain type of love. There is a famous novel called The Stepford Wives by the author Ira Levin. And in The Stepford Wives, it's set in a town called Stepford, And it's really creepy, but the husbands in the town of Stepford have decided that their wives are not fully pleasing to them. Their wives are not always willing to do whatever the husband wants. They have their own wills and their own choices that they want to make, and it's not always what their husband would choose. And so, having a genius roboticist in their midst, the husbands of Stepford start knocking off their wives one by one and replacing them with robots who were always submissive, always happy to do whatever the husband wants. And you look at that situation and you say, well, okay, after the wives are all replaced, is there any genuine love in the town of Stepford? Well, no, because the wives are, so-called wives, are robots. They're just programmed to do things. They don't actually love their husbands, no matter what they behave like. And the husbands certainly didn't love their wives. They killed them and replaced them by robots. They literally instrumentalized their wives. And so there is no genuine love here. And without some experience of freedom, you can't, and the ability to choose either love or non-love, you don't have freely chosen love. And God wants that. He doesn't just want robotic, programmed love behaviors. He wants both us and the angels to choose to love him freely, and then at some point we commit, in the case of humans, we commit to that choice, which is the moment of death for us. So if you look at the problem of evil and say, well, could God have done it a different way, or was he required to do it, or was this the best way? Well, there are various aspects of that you can discuss, but fundamentally, in order to allow freely chosen love, God needed to allow free will, and thus God needed to allow the possibility of someone choosing non-love or evil. And so there is kind of a necessary connection on the moral evil side between the goal that God is achieving, which is freely chosen love, and the instrument that he's chosen to get there of allowing free will. When it comes to physical evil, though, I don't think that's the case. I think there are multiple different ways that God could achieve the same good. Let's take our coronavirus vaccination example. Well, if you watch Star Trek, especially if you watch the original series, you'll see Dr. McCoy come up to people and uses hypospray on them, even through their shirt, and they don't feel any pain. They don't wince, they don't go, ow, or anything like that. You hear this noise, and they've got whatever vaccination they need. Well, we actually have something like that today. We do have hyposprays. They're not commonly used, but we do have them. And even without a hypospray, you could use a topical anesthetic on somebody's arm before giving them an injection. And there are ways that God could eliminate all suffering and still achieve the same good. But that still doesn't change the fact that if we suffer innocently, God will more than compensate us for it. And so we still have a guarantee from God that we'll come out on the plus side of things. He's not going to allow us to be treated unfairly. And it's up to him whether or not he chooses to use one more painful or one less painful or one non-painful means of getting to a specific good. I don't have a problem with that. If the millionaire genius doctor comes to me and says, you know, I could do this other thing, but here's the deal I'm offering you. I'll give you an injection in the normal way with an intramuscular needle, and it'll hurt for a second, but it'll give you these immunity to the coronavirus, and I'll give you $1 million. I'm still up for that. You know, if he chooses that that's how he's going to administer this to me and other people, hopefully, great. I'm not in this for the quibbling. The benefits he's giving me vastly outweigh anything I go through in getting them.
That's a wonderful example. So on the topic of free will, because this is closely intertwined, of course, with the problem of suffering and evil, is it limiting in God's omnipotence and God's omniscience and God's this idea of who God is to say that, well, maybe he could have made a world with free will but without evil, and he didn't do that, so he's somehow limited in his abilities? Does that make any sense?
Well, so he couldn't make a world that had free will of the type we're talking about that didn't allow for moral evil. The type of moral freedom we're talking about is the freedom to choose either love, which is good, or non-love, which is evil. And you can't allow that kind of freedom without allowing moral evil to exist. So it would, again, be just word salad. It would be like four-sided triangle to say that God creates a world that allows for free will but not evil in any form. The question would then be, what about physical evil? Could he make a world that allows for moral evil but not physical evil? And this is an area where I think there, personally, I need to think more about it. What I have meditated on in the past about this is that there seems to be a connection between moral evil and physical evil, where if I choose moral evil, that seems to imply some kind of physical evil as a result of the moral evil. Because if I choose to be cruel to someone, that person is going to suffer as a result. On my end, there's moral evil. On their end, there's physical evil. And consequently, there is a logical connection between the two forms of evil. There may be physical evil without moral evil, like in the case of a virus. The virus isn't doing anything morally evil. It's just trying to reproduce. But in the case of, there does seem to be a connection between moral evil performed by a rational agent and physical evil that is its consequence. Now, you could say, well, okay, could God let me choose to do a morally evil act? Could I choose to be cruel to someone, and then he could intervene to stop that person suffering? Well, it looks to me, based on the present state of my thought, that yeah, he probably could. God could let us make morally evil choices, but then do something that prevents the physical evil that would imply from happening. And it would be an interesting world where every bad thought you had and every evil choice you made was suddenly stifled in its consequences. But here, I think we'd be back to the fundamental principle that we discussed earlier of, if God allows that person to suffer innocently because of what I did, because of my choice to be cruel, God will more than make it up to that person. And so it's still fundamentally the case that God is giving that person a good deal, that even if he allows my moral evil to have physical effects on others, he'll more than make it up to those people, so they still come out in the plus column.
I think something else I want to touch on that you underscored earlier, and I think this is so fundamental in understanding this whole problem, is you said earlier that God is going to make those things right more than pay us back for the evil we suffer, but not necessarily in this lifetime. Can you unpack that a little bit more? Because I think that's really important for somebody who doesn't necessarily believe in eternity. I mean, this problem becomes difficult to grasp, but as Catholics, this explains a lot of, I think, the long view on suffering.
Yeah. So from a human point of view, you look at, regardless of your faith commitments, you look at what happens in this life, and innocent people do suffer, like Rabbi Kushner's son with progeria, or St. Paul when he was martyred. For people who may not be aware, that he was, according to the historical evidence we have, he was martyred about the year AD 67. In Rome, and he was beheaded. And he was, St. Peter was also martyred in Rome in the AD 60s. He was crucified, but St. Paul was a Roman citizen, so they couldn't crucify him, and so they beheaded him instead, because crucifixion was not done to Roman citizens. But, you know, he's an innocent guy from a Catholic point of view. He had his flaws, but he didn't deserve to be killed in that way. He didn't do anything to deserve death. And so consequently, he suffered innocently. Well, if he's going to be rewarded or more than compensated for the suffering of martyrdom that he underwent, it obviously is not in this life. And so from a Catholic point of view, it's something that has to come after this life. And therefore, the existence of innocent suffering, coupled with the fact that people aren't always compensated in this life, provides, from a theistic point of view, an argument for life after death. And it may be worthwhile noting, broadening our perspective a little bit, this is also something that is an argument for life after death in other non-theistic religions, like in Hinduism and Buddhism. And Jainism, they talk about the law of karma. The idea with the law of karma is that good actions will be rewarded, bad actions will result in suffering. And it's clear that some people do good actions in this life and they aren't rewarded in this life. So there must be a future life. And in those religions, they interpret that to mean a reincarnation. I would point out, now, from a Christian point of view, we'd say it's either the intermediate state or in the resurrected life. But I would point out that the existence of unrewarded goods and uncompensated sufferings does point to life after death. It doesn't point to a specific form of life after death, but it does point to life after death. And so I think both religious perspectives, both reincarnationists and resurrectionists, can point to examples of this that are obviously out there in the world and say, this: if there's justice in the universe, then this innocent suffering has to be compensated for, and good actions that have not been rewarded in this life have to be rewarded, and that points to some form of life after death. And then here are two different interpretations of what that involves. By the way, if folks want to hear more about that, and I have an upcoming discussion on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. We're doing a two-parter on reincarnation, and I will be going into the arguments about karma and what a Christian would have to say about karma. To what extent does it contain a valid principle, but also to what extent does it not show what reincarnationists might think?
That's a great resource. One of the most frequently cited arguments, I mean, this problem of evil is a massive, an ancient problem, right, that we've wrestled with in world religions
since the beginning of human history. Humans have suffered and wondered why.
One of the most common things that you hear, at least lately, are these examples of natural disasters or these different kind of evils. I mean, you hear of a children's hospital. Why do children have to suffer? Or why does God allow natural disasters? Or what good could have come from the Holocaust? Or why do we suffer these global pandemics? What... Mm-hmm. You've certainly touched on these things, on the reason why God would allow these things, but how do we answer in a broader sense some of these big picture things when they just seem so senseless sometimes?
Well, I think we have to look at different aspects of it, because it's not a single answer that applies to all of them. We can ask, okay, why would God allow this particular evil or this class of evils? And in the case of moral evil, we have a pretty good answer there. We understand that fairly well. It's because he's allowing the free will in order to allow freely chosen love. When it comes to other things, and we look at, say, natural disasters, we can see some of the goods that he's achieving by those. Now, natural disasters, and I talk about this in my book, A Daily Defense. I have, you know, several brief treatments of different aspects of the problem of evil. And one of them is natural disasters. So let's say there's an earthquake or an asteroid impact. Okay, let's take the asteroid impact. Well, We had a major asteroid impact here on Earth 65 million years ago, and it killed the dinosaurs, or at least it was part of what killed the dinosaurs. Actually, there are also other reasons, it looks like, why the dinosaurs may have been dying. There were massive volcanic eruptions in India, and also it looks like there may have been a series of asteroid and comet impacts that killed the dinosaurs. But there is one big one off the Yucatan in Mexico, and that's the one that gets the attention. So you know, God allowed these natural disasters to end up killing the dinosaurs. Well, what did that do? Well, one of the goods that came out of that was when the dinosaurs, who were the dominant creatures in the ecosystem of the Earth at the time, at least as far as animal life was concerned, when they died, it opened up all kinds of ecological niches, and that created new opportunities for life forms to evolve into those niches, and that allowed mammals, including our ancestors, to evolve. So we would not be here if the dinosaurs had continued. Mammals had already been around. Mammals actually evolved earlier than reptiles, or earlier than the dinosaurs in any event. And the dinosaurs took over, and were, because they were occupying all of those top slots in the ecosystem, our ancestors, the mammals, didn't have a chance until the dinosaurs ended up dying off. So we can see how God used this natural disaster or series of natural disasters, which we will also be talking about on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and in fact recently did in our episode on the Nemesis Death Star theory. God used that physical evil for the dinosaurs. It was physical evil for them, but it was a good for us because it allowed our ancestors to evolve and develop, and eventually we got human beings out of the process. And so we can see in the case of many instances of physical evil, how a good is promoted. There's a saying that's used in some circles, the death of one is the life of another. And I've just illustrated that with us and the dinosaurs, but it gets illustrated on the small scale all the time. If you watch nature documentaries and you see a lion hunting down a zebra, well, the zebra experiences physical death. That's a physical evil. But the lion gets physical life. That's a physical good. And so we can see in many of these cases very easily what good is coming out of it. We also can see it in our own case in many instances. If you are a little kid and you put your hand on a hot stove, the pain you experience is going to motivate you to take your hand off the stove. And in fact, there's a condition known as congenital insensitivity to pain, where people don't have that reflex and they don't experience pain when they injure themselves. And as a result, they end up injuring themselves, sometimes very badly. And so even though pain is classified as a physical evil, we can see very clearly how the pain reflex and the pains in our nervous, the pain receptors, the nociceptors in our nervous system, actually provide a life-saving function for us to keep us from dangerously injuring ourselves. So, and in fact, that's their primary function. It's only like when something goes wrong in your system, like you get cancer and it starts to impress on nerves that it shouldn't, because it shouldn't be there, and it causes pain that way. That's the exception. Most of the time, our pain receptors, our nociceptors, are actually helping us out. They are performing a good. And so in many cases, we can see what good particular physical evils are performing. Now, we can't in all, and there is a lot of mystery in life. According to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, and this seems validated by human experience and theological reflection, we can't always explain what particular evil or what particular good is going to come out of an evil. But we can trust that a good God would not allow an evil unless he had a way to bring good out of it. And this is something that I often talk about when I give talks about the problem of evil. I actually go back to an injection example. So we've all had the experience of being very small children and being taken to the doctor and being given our inoculations from various childhood diseases. I know I certainly remember that. And it was not a fun experience. You know, you think about it, you're a small child. And even if you don't remember it, this happened to you if your parents were not irresponsible anti-vaxxers. You got taken to the child as an infant, as a toddler, and you were held down quite possibly by your very own parents while a stranger, either a doctor or a nurse, inserted a sharp object into your body, and it hurt, and it was terrifying, and you screamed and wailed, and nevertheless, your parents were letting this stranger do this horrible thing to you. Well, what you didn't know at that age is this is actually going to spare you lots of suffering. By inoculating you from these childhood diseases, you're going to be spared lots of suffering, and it may be saving your life. But you didn't have the perspective at the time to appreciate that that's what your parents were doing. Now, as you got older, you could understand, oh, there's a reason why I need to get a shot. And in my own development, I really got on board with the I need a shot thing, because I have allergies, and one of my allergies is to poison ivy. And growing up in the South, every summer, all poison ivy had to do was look at me, and I would break out and itch for months. And the only thing, and they try things like, let's put calamine lotion on it, and that never did any good. The only thing that would fix it was a cortisone shot. And after I learned that, every summer when I would get poison ivy, it's like, I want a cortisone shot. And the doctors would be like, oh, no. Let's try calamine lotion for it. It's like, no, you do not understand. Cortisone shot now. And so as I grew, I recognized that it's much better to get some of these injections than to go through the suffering that happens without them. And so I could appreciate my parents' decision to take me to the doctor to get me injections, because I now had this broader perspective. And the church holds that something like that happens in our cases. In this life, we are kind of like the small children in that we don't see the reasons why God is allowing these things. What we didn't know as small children is that our parents really did have a good reason for it. This really was going to help us. And since we're not literally small children in this life, we can apply that principle to God and say, God is our Father, just like we could trust our parents, even though we didn't know it, we could trust our parents that there was a good reason for letting us have this injection, that it will bring about greater good. We can, as adult Christians, have the same faith in God, that He's our loving Father, and if He's allowing us to go through something, He has a reason for it. He will bring some good out of it, even if we can't see it in this life. Maybe when we grow up even more and see Him in the next life and have various mysteries revealed to us, maybe we'll understand it then, but even now, we can trust Him just like we could trust our parents.
Well, let's get a little more personal to end off this discussion, because, you know, to a person who's truly experiencing suffering or evil, some of these theoretical kind of solutions sometimes just fall flat. And I wonder, I know that you've had this question a number of times, you've given talks on this, and there's actually a fantastic talk on formed.org that you give on this exact topic, and right now that's free. Oh. They're offering that free to everybody right now. Formed.org from the Augustine Institute. Fantastic talk from Catholic Answers. I wonder how you would explain the problem of suffering and evil to people who are in the thick of it, who just kind of, you know, that practical, hands-on experiencing evil and suffering. Where do you begin to unpack that for those kind of people?
I begin by not explaining it. I begin by just being compassionate and doing what I can to help comfort the person. To the extent that the person wants to get into the intellectual side of this problem, I'm happy to help. But it's not a smart move to lead with that. If someone is, you know, saying, oh man, I just lost my wife. You know, I've been there. I've lost my wife. She died of cancer when she was amazingly young. I've lost other people in my life. And when someone is in the throes of hurting, they don't want a philosophy lecture. They want comfort. They want consolation. They want sympathy. And that's what you need to give them. And if they, you know, are asking the why question, I'll give them the least intrusive answer I can. I'm not going to unload all the theory on them. I'll say, there are reasons, and you can have faith, and God loves you anyway, and He Himself was willing to undergo suffering for our sake. So God on the cross suffered with us, and He cares. And I'll leave it at this very basic level. And if they want more, I'll give them more, but they have to signal that they want that greater discussion. I'm not going to force it on a suffering person. The last thing I want to do is add to their burden by giving them a bunch of unhelpful stuff that doesn't address where they are in the moment. I may even say, look, you know, we could talk about this more when the hurt isn't so raw. You know, it may be, I may discern that where the person's at right now, it would not be helpful to have this discussion, even if they're asking for it. Because there are times where people are, they just want to lash out, and they're looking for an excuse to lash out in pain. And if I sense that someone's in that situation, and if I try to give them the here are the reasons thing now, they're just going to lash out against that because they're hurting so much, I'll defer that discussion. Say, we don't need to talk about this now. I just want you to know that I love you and I care about you and we'll get through this. If they, on the other hand, are trying to sincerely engage it intellectually, if they have the clarity, if they're not hurting too much that it prevents that and they really want it, then I'll give them basic answers. You know, like God wouldn't allow this to happen if He didn't have a way to bring good out of it. And we may not know what that good is right now, but we will. And the glories of, even if, you know, things are going badly in this life is not the end. We have eternity before us, and God can more than make it up to us, and He will. And I may share, you know, some of those verses from St. Paul with them. But I'll, in approaching someone who's hurting right now, my overall approach is going to be show them compassion and sympathy and understanding, and get into the theoretical side of this in as minimal a way as possible, and then scale up step by step according to what they currently want and need, and don't try to force more on them than they're presently ready for.
Yeah, I think that's so well said. You know, I'm a convert from evangelical Christianity. I know you're a convert too. And for me, one of the fundamental shifts in my thinking about suffering and evil, and this is very, very surface levelly, but at the same time very, very deep, is just as a Catholic, you know, going from a context where we had a cross in our church, going from that context where we now have in Catholic churches a crucifix, and seeing that Christ is suffering alongside of us because we see Him right there in a very tangible way, that for me was a very fundamental shift in my understanding of how to approach suffering. Just seeing as a Catholic that, yes, Christ is suffering alongside me. Does mm-hmm. that make sense to you?
Sure. Of course, Catholics also have bear crosses that they use, but it is a more visual depiction. And there are others that are even more visual. I was in a church in Waco, Texas once, and I walked around a corner, and there was a statue of Christ scourged, you know, with all of the marks of scourging all over His body. And it's like, wow, that was intense. But that's what really happened. And, you know, for some people, and at some times, watching something like Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, it can be profoundly moving, and it really can help people understand God's, you know, suffering on the cross and in the Passion in general, and how much He loves us. There were when The Passion of the Christ came out, I remember there was one case of a guy who had committed murder who went and saw that, and he was so revolutionized by seeing it, he turned himself in for the murder. He wanted to repent that much because he saw what Jesus had done on his behalf. And, of course, our Protestant friends, even though they don't commonly have crucifixes, you know, they will have films, you know, of Jesus, you know, films that depict Jesus on the cross, and they have illustrations in, you know, in Bible story books and things like that. So it's not alien to them either, but it is more common in Catholic circles.
Well, Jimmy, this has been a fabulous discussion. I appreciate your time. I think listeners will be incredibly edified by this discussion and will just love it. So I thank you so much for being here. Before you go, can you tell our listeners where to find out more about what you're doing, what you're writing, what you're up to, and all that kind of stuff?
Sure. So my personal website is jimmyakin.com. That's JimmyAkin. No added E's, S's, or T's. It's as simple as it sounds, akin.com. And I use that as an online hub for various things I write. My day job is at Catholic Answers, so they can go to catholic.com to catch up with what I do there. And also, if they want to learn, you know, I have a great appreciation for mysteries from both the faith and reason perspectives. And if they want to check out what I do on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, they can go to sqpn.com or just put Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World into the Google machine and it'll come right up.
It's a fantastic podcast, and everything you write, Jimmy, all your speaking, everywhere you go, I follow you closely, and listeners should as well. It's fantastic content. I want to say God bless you. God bless your ministry. We work for the church. Thanks for being here, and take care.
My pleasure, and I'd encourage everybody, especially in this time of pandemic, that we all keep everybody, ourselves, our friends, our loved ones, and everyone in the world in prayer. And I know you have some listeners who may not be theists, but if you're open to the possibility of maybe there is something out there, maybe say a prayer anyway, just conditionally. God, if you're out there, please help us.
Amen. Thank you so much, Jimmy.
Thank you.
God bless. Thank you once again for listening to this episode of The Cordial Catholic. Big thanks to Jimmy Akin, my guest this week, for his fantastic explanation for that fantastic discussion of the problem of evil and suffering. The show notes for this show are at thecordialcatholic.com. I'm cordialcatholic@gmail.com for your questions, for your feedback. Please do reach out. Let me know who you are, where you are listening from, and why you are listening, and how I can pray for you as well. Guys, I am praying and fasting for all my listeners this Lenten season, and that's just gotten even more deepened, I guess, with this whole pandemic. So please know that I am praying for you every single day. The Cordial Catholic on Twitter, The Cordial Catholic on Facebook, and please do follow this podcast on Spotify, subscribe to it on iTunes, and hey, if you can leave a rating or a review on those platforms, that helps push the podcast out to new people and increases the effort of evangelization which underpins this whole thing. Patreon.com/cordialcatholic to join the community of sponsors there at Patreon. That money all goes back into the show to help keep this thing going, guys, and I thank you very much. PayPal.me/cordialcatholic for a one-time donation, and thank you. God bless, guys. See you again next week, and I'm praying for you. Please pray for me too. This show is brought to you in a special way by our co-producer patrons over at patreon.com/cordialcatholic. A special thanks to Ellie and Tom, Kelvin and Susan, Stephen, Suzanne and Victor, Phil, Noah, Nicole, Michelle, Jordan, John, James, Gina, and Aram for your special support at the co-producer tier and making this thing possible. You guys are fantastic. God bless and thanks for your support.